chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm delighted to have Kimberly Martin on the show today. Kimberly is the Executive Vice President of Business Operations and Automation at MasterCard. So welcome to the show, Kim. I am so delighted to have you join me today. Thank you so much for making the time. I know how busy you are.
Thank you for inviting me. It's quite an honor.
Well, yes, and I know we're going to talk about this, but you lead teams globally, so you probably started your day at 3 or something this morning.
I actually did.
Did you? I knew that you started really early, my goodness. Well, I mean, Kim, listen, we have known each other for a very long time, but, you know, we're not going to say exactly how long. We were 12 when we started, right?
We were children. Yeah,
we were just children. Exactly. And it was back in the McDonnell Douglas days. I was in accounting for McDonnell Douglas, and you and Greg were both software engineers.
Very much so.
And met each other. And it's just crazy. We loved our time at McDonnell Douglas. And I know you did, too.
Such a great training ground.
Excellent. But, you know, you have had a wonderful career in tech, and we've got so much to dig into there. But I really would love for you to take me back to your childhood. And I believe you grew up in Carbondale, Illinois, which is not too far from my hometown, Paducah, Kentucky.
Oh, yeah. Very close.
We would go to Carbondale for concerts and stuff. But tell me this. What did you like to do as a young girl?
I liked bossing people around, so I was apparently really good at it. So, like, when the neighborhood kids get together, I was in charge of, like, this is what we're going to play. This is the rules we're going to play by. I also loved organizing things. I think about this all the time. My parents were crazy to let me do it, but they let me organize the entire house. No one lets an 8-year-old organize their stuff. But my best days were rainy days when I would go into this storage room. Everybody's got a junk room. And I would like move stuff around. I wasn't good at it. Like, I would put boxes within boxes so you could never find them. But I liked taking chaos and making order out of it. And that sort of has stuck with me ever since.
Well, that's sometimes what you have to do with technology, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's probably my best skill, in fact.
Yeah. Oh, that is so awesome. Well, I mean, I know in STEM, I don't even think became a thing until an official acronym until 2001. But did you find yourself? And I mean, I think that that's probably a component is bringing order out of chaos in technology. But were there other things that kind of interested you? Were you interested in science or any of that kind of thing in school?
Math, for sure. And I liked math because it made sense. Like, there's a right answer. There's not this chaos, you know, vague answers. And so when I was in elementary school and high school, math were my favorite subjects. Math and English were my top two things. And then I thought, taking that into college, accounting would be my thing because, hey, you know, accounting is math, right? It's not really. Accounting is logic. And that was not my best thing. And so I realized that, man, I had made a course correction that I was actually through my last class in accounting in SIUE. I was an accounting major, and I was on an accelerated program, so I was about to get done in 3 years, and I was interviewing for accounting jobs, and I was just miserable, and I'm like, I don't want to do this. I don't think I'll be good at this, in fact. And so I had that epiphany moment where I was like, I need to figure something else out. And I went back through the classes that I'd had so far, because they have tastes of certain classes. And so the only class that really resonated with me was an IT class. And remember, this was back, you know, in the early 1980s. So there weren't a lot of IT classes. And I thought, that was the most fun because it was a lot like math. There's a right answer. You can tell when you get to the right answer, the program works. And so I pivoted and I just pulled it back. And I said, look, I'm going to take another year, but I'm going to focus on an IT degree. And that's how I ended up in IT.
I love that. So you may not know this, but I'm going to just say it. So Greg did the same thing. So he's 2 years older. He went to college. I thought I was going to do something in medicine. I had, you know, I was pretty much on that path to medicine. And he's like, Lisa, you need to go into accounting. He had declared his major's accounting. Go into accounting. And when we graduate from college, we'll start an accounting firm. And I said, I never even took typing in high school, you know. I took all these science classes, right? And so I did. I took principles. And now Greg went on and finished his accounting degree. But Kim, he did the same thing. Yeah. He's like, you know, I just really like computers better. Yeah. And, you know, as when the old, you know, big behemoth of, you know, mainframes and yeah. You had the punch cards, yep. Remember?
We were punch card kids.
Punch card kids. And yeah, so he got a double major. He took another year.
That's exactly what I did.
Isn't that crazy? But yeah, I kind of decided my senior year. I thank God for the accountants out there. Thank you that you love it and we need you. So please don't stop what you're doing. But even my senior year, I'm like, ooh, I'm not sure this is really for me. I should have gone into sales or marketing, you know, is what I thought. But I did. I went on and practiced, you know, corporate accounting at Mac. And I would say it's a wonderful foundation.
Absolutely.
For especially when you start your own business, right? And you need to understand financials, and you do too, because you have your own P&L. And
it has been a gift that I think some of my colleagues struggle with sometimes, but I am on top of my financials, and you have to be when you're running a team of any size. Yes. And I thank God for that foundation. It's not maybe something that I use every day, but it's something that I definitely benefited from.
Absolutely. Yeah. So it is definitely a great foundation. Well, you went on, you got an MS from SIUE too. And then I've got to ask you this, you went on and got a doctorate, Kim. So my goodness, what inspired you to go ahead and do that? Was there a person that said, hey, or I think you're probably a student of leadership and probably just a student. You're always learning, right?
Well, growth mindset. Yeah, I thought about it for a long time. It was just sort of a, you know, like a bucket list thing, something that you'd like to do, especially if you really like school. I like school a lot. But I didn't think I had anything worthy to study. To do a doctoral study, you have to have a doctoral thesis. What are you going to study? You need to contribute to humanity in some way. And I'm like, I don't have anything big. You need to have something that you think adds to the body of work out there. And so a lot of years go by, like 30 years go by. And the other thing is, like, I wanted it to be a doctorate in something, a discipline that I cared about, like project management or business administration. And there weren't schools that offered a doctorate in that near where I lived. And so with the advent of online learning and distance schools, that opened up the possibility. So then I could start looking out across the nation. I wasn't limited to the St. Louis metro area to find a school. So the combination of being able to pick, you know, an online course, an online set of studies, and then I found a degree program in a topic that I cared about, that made all the difference.
So what was that topic and what was your thesis? What was the new body of work that you...
So it's pretty dry, but it's the productivity factors influencing globally distributed agile teams.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
But it was what I was leading at the time. I was leading teams globally distributed around the world, in the U.S. and Europe and India. And I had found this phenomenon. It was super interesting. I had this team. Yeah, you got time for this story? Yeah,
absolutely.
I had this team that was in the U.S. and we were using a contingent workforce that sat in Malaysia. So on the other side of the horizon. So a lot of the communication was done it's asynchronous. And then I had a team in Ireland from a company that we had just acquired, and they'd never worked with a contingent workforce. They'd never had people that weren't part of their company that they hired. And so they were going to need to hire some contingent workers. And this team in the U.S. came to me and said, look, this isn't working out. These people are not great. We're using them to test some of our code. They're not great at testing. And I said, so you can't find anything else you want them to do because it's a good team and we've onboarded them. And they're like, nope. But we found this team in Brazil that we really want to work with. We've talked to them. They're really, really smart. And I said, okay, let's pivot so you can use them. So now I have this team free up that was in Malaysia, and I had my team in Ireland that needed to supplement their skills. So I used them. I said, look, I don't want to get your hopes up. I mean, I hear they're not great, but they could maybe take some work off your plate so that you can do some important software development work. And they said, sure. No, this would be great. And so I said, I really feel like you're getting your hopes up a lot. So just want to temper that. So yes. They went off and they made a connection. And so I checked in a few weeks later. How's it going? Great. And I said, seriously, great. And I say, he said, no, really. In fact, we're giving them coding assignments. They're supplementing what we're doing. I'm like, you're not just having them test. You're having them write code. This is a pretty important project that we're doing. And they're like, no, they're writing good code. I said, that is so interesting. Meanwhile, my team in the U.S. says, this team in Brazil, they are awesome. They are rocking it. And I'm like, that is so odd because now you have this perfect petri dish of a team in Malaysia. Nobody on the team changed. One group of people thought they were useless. In fact, we were willing to, you know, step away and disassociate from them. Another team starts using them, and they're pretty smart developers too, and they think they're amazing. What changed? Because it certainly wasn't the team.
What's the difference?
It was the location of the team. It was their ability to connect synchronously, to have those conversations. My team in Ireland made accommodations. So they had a half a day, business day of overlap. They spent every morning with the team in Malaysia, walking through the day. They got to know them as people. There's a whole bunch of things that were factors here. They had a trust factor going on. They humanized the team. They did a team newsletter to learn what everybody's favorite things were, what the favorite movie were that they'd seen the week before. But more importantly, they were able to connect at least half a business day. And I thought, I wonder if that plays out around the world. I bet we see this at MasterCard. So I talked to my boss, which is Ed McLaughlin, the president of our technology company, and he is a huge fan of learning. And I said, would you be okay if I did a doctoral study using our Agile data? So pulling from our Agile storyboards and connecting back to people, anonymizing everybody. But I knew their location. So I knew if teams were in the same building. I knew if teams were in the same city, but in a different building. So not everybody could be around the table. They could be talking like you and I are today. And so I grouped in the different categories of how far away in the world the teams were. And the study sort of played out what we saw in real life. And that felt like something worthy to contribute back. Because when I started looking at the data, no one had really contributed from a live corporation this kind of data. There were mock studies done in university, but nobody studied an entire workforce of 10,000 developers to see how this played out.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. That is so amazing. So I'm sure even you doing that, you know, and contributing to a new body of work like that, Kim has even informed how you guys have done things going forward.
100%. When we started doing distributed software development, we would put people in a team together, like two people in the U.S., two people in Ireland, two people in India. That was the worst combination of working together we could have done. We would have been so much smarter, and the studies back that up. There are other studies out there now that back up the same thing that says, then put an entire intact team in a geographic area. Don't spread them across the horizon. You can talk. There's still benefit to, like, you still get productivity benefit if you're able to talk synchronously during the day. You don't have to actually be in the same room. But the best, the most productive teams were those that were live face-to-face. But it wasn't statistically different or significant if they weren't face-to-face, but they were able to talk synchronously. So it was really about being able to clarify things, being able to have those conversations when you need to have them and not delay. Even a half a business day delay was still considered productive. It wasn't statistically different enough that you impacted the study. It was only when you were over the horizon, when you were not a business, you were more than a business day away.
Wow, that is amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that's going to help our listeners as they're thinking about distributed teams like this. Kim, I know it's going to help us. So
that,
thank you
so
much.
That fascinating 100-page thesis is out there on ProQuest if you want to read it.
Well, for a little light reading if you're interested, right? Oh, my goodness. Well, let's move on. Like your career, you started A.G. Edwards, which is a very iconic brand for St. Louis.
Yeah.
That was before they were purchased by Wachovia and then purchased by Wells Fargo. And, you know, it's been kind of a crazy, crazy time for them, you know, in terms of acquisition. But then you worked at BJC and then you came to McDonnell Douglas and then you came to MasterCard. And you've been at MasterCard for 32 years, Kim, which is incredible. How many jobs have you had? How many roles have you had while you've been at MasterCard?
I don't think I can count them. I think because they're constantly evolving. Every year it's a different role than the year before. Even though I maybe don't get a different title, it's never the same thing. I think the funniest part is when I came to MasterCard, the company before MasterCard, it was a sales company. It was a tech sales company. It was so much fun. The folks I work with in St. Louis, I was the tech lead that would go out with the salespeople, so I didn't have to sell. That was way too much pressure. But being able to talk about the technology and then go and install it and teach it was fun. That lasted 6 months, and then they got bought. And I didn't relate to the company that bought them. The company that bought them had a culture that I didn't align with. Mm-hmm. And that culture map is like super important. And so I just needed a place to land for a year. And so I had a friend from a previous role who had a friend at MasterCard, and that's how I landed at MasterCard. She said, they're hiring and they will take you. And I just needed a place for a year. And so when I came into it, I was looking at just 1 year. I just need 1 year.
1 year.
Where I figure out what I really want to do with my life. And I fell in love. I fell in love with the technology, with the culture, with the people, and it just evolved from 1 year to 32.
Yeah. You know, a mutual friend of ours, Gary Vonnehar, I remember talking to Gary and he's like, oh yeah, I think at the time he had been there for 18 years and he said he'd had 9 lives since he'd been there. But I think MasterCard does a phenomenal job at that, right? And giving people new opportunities and moving people around. So let me ask you this. So you've had a lot of different roles. You are currently the EVP, the Executive Vice President of Business Operations and Automation. But how, Kim, can you like kind of describe, how do you think each role has built on the other? You know, it's really important. It's kind of like building blocks, right?
Yeah. And I think it's interesting that, you know, that's how most people's career goes. And I think God puts you in the right place at the right time for the very next thing. At least that's how it works in my life, or how it feels like it works. So, you know, I started out here, I was a software developer and a project manager, and then I took on more responsibility and became a people manager, and I got to launch a new segment that MasterCard was launching called fraud, because fraud was a big thing 32 years ago. We didn't have fraud products. We didn't have neural networks. And I got to build our very first neural network here at MasterCard. And wow, we learned a lot about how we didn't know a lot about data science 32 years ago. We're so amazing today, but 32 years ago, that was a new field for us. And so as those things progressed, every one of them was a building block on the last one. And the opportunity that I got on the next thing was I had a really hard problem to solve, and it looked like it was going to be very bumpy. And we got through to the other side. And that getting through, having the grit to get through, got the opportunity to say, hey, you did this really well. I know you don't know anything about this other thing, but I bet you could do it. And so, and then the willingness to jump in and learn. Like, you have to be a lifelong learner, I think, to be in technology, period. So those lifelong learning skills and being willing to learn and immerse yourself. So then I moved into the data warehouse and I immersed myself in big data, you know, and I learned a lot about how hard it was to manage big data working on the neural network. And the big data was important. We brought in the first big data machines, appliances at MasterCard. They were a relatively new thing. The game changer for how fast we were able to access information and turn it into knowledge. And then from there, you know, leading software development teams, leading different parts of our business. And then the most recent role, which I didn't appreciate how hard or different it would be, was the last job I had before the business operations role. I was leading the commercial software development team. And so we sell to corporate software. And it had been very bumpy, like it wasn't quality software. So we had put a whole business operations practice in to build Stellar, test Stellar software, and then run it well. And run well was the most important part. That's how we show up to our customers. Customers aren't particularly interested about your pipeline of your feature development. It's like, I just need it to work every day. You know, I'm interested in the things that are coming, but it needs to work every day. And when Ed McLaughlin came in to be our president, he's like, I want that discipline across the whole organization. So I just want you to go every product, not just one product, but I want you to focus on the run discipline across the organization. I'm like, sure. I mean, what, you want me to write like a guidebook or something? Like, no, I want you to actually lead it. Like, make sure every team is organized the same way, has the same set of values, and gets up every day and makes run the most important thing. And we're going to call it a guild because everybody has similar set of skills. It doesn't matter what product line they're supporting. They all need to do the same function. I didn't appreciate how hard it was to run a guild. A guild is very different than running a software development team where, like, when you're in charge, you can say, to Tuesday, we're all doing this. These people didn't all work on things that I controlled. I had to influence, and that's part of the job of the guild, is to influence their hopes and dreams and what they buy into as the mission of, like, this is what we stand for, that, you know. And so one of the best pieces of advice he gave me when starting this, he goes, don't go big, just pick five things that you want to do and do really well. Like, just list those five things and make them simple. So, you know, the first thing I said was honor our promises. We make promises to customers every day. We ought to honor them. That ought to be our first value statement. So I didn't know it at the time, but we were coming up with a value statement that needed to resonate. And if it didn't resonate with people, they probably don't want to work on this team. And so it gets back to the culture has to align and your values have to align with the team that you're working on. And so keeping those short and crisp made it, like, I think, iconic for us. And by the way, they've served us well because we haven't changed the value statement in the 7 years that we've had the guild. But it gave people something to rally around. And for a job that can be really tough, like production support and operations, you get like the 3 a.m. phone calls a lot.
Sure.
People, when we framed it, like, you make a difference in people's lives. And people, we don't always talk about it like that, but I said, you're the thing that's honoring the promise, that's keeping, like, the people connected to their funds. For example, if you're that mom at 2 a.m. that's running into Walgreens because you got to get medicine for your sick baby, you know, that credit card has to work, or that debit card has to work. You don't want to separate them from their funds. Or I thought about it when we had the war in Europe, and, you know, people were trying to get out of Ukraine, and they were using their credit cards to get out of the country to buy train tickets. And it's like, if you were in a war zone and you were trying to use your card, it better work. So it wasn't just enough that we made sure that the technology worked. We had to also make sure that the infrastructure was connected and that they weren't disrupted, you know, by the things that were happening in their country.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. Well, I was going to ask you, that's funny. You already answered kind of the question for me, but I was going to say, I know that you report to Ed, which you and I've kind of talked offline. I've read a lot of the things he's written. Amazing, amazing leader. I was going to ask you, what are some of the top things that you learned from him? But I love what he said to you. You know, don't go and try to boil the ocean. Pick five things. And I love those value statements that are still holding true today. So I want to kind of move into this. Kim, I know you're super passionate about this, but, you know, when you started in tech, there was a real inequity in the number of females, but MasterCard in particular has been really intentional about encouraging more young women. And another good friend of both mine and yours is Dana Lorberg. Yeah. And I think about what she did with Girls for Tech. She's retired now. And although I'm not sure she's really
she's
doing
quasi-retired.
Well,
retired.
I'm like, I think she's failing at retirement because she's so busy with other things, right? But Girls for Tech. But what else has MasterCard done? And, you know, what could you tell, like, our listeners that are in organizations that really are still trying to figure that out? What kind of advice would you give them? What kind of ideas would you give them?
Well, what Dana did, which was, I think, innovative, is she said, look, if we wait until kids get in college, they've already made life choices by college. We need to meet girls when they're in middle school or before they get into middle school, because that's where they're deciding whether STEM is even interesting or not, and give them a picture of what STEM could be, because I think they see it in the movies and they see, like, the lonely programmer living in his mom's basement, and that is not what STEM is. And they don't even know that they probably do STEM activities every day, and they're not, and these are opening up up a world of possibilities to them before they even start making those choices closer to high school. But once they go to school, then attracting them in your organization, we found that we were looking and we were recruiting and trying to make our job descriptions as, you know, gender appealing as possible. And we still weren't getting a lot of great candidates applying for our roles. And one of the recruiters said to me one day is, if you would let me open these up at a more junior level, I could get you a ton of candidates. And if you're willing to look for a non-traditional workforce, people that have done something different, but they're coming in as the entry level. So maybe they've had a career in something else. And I'm like, yes, of course we're open. And what we're finding is the entry level, you still have to grow the pyramid. Like they will grow, they'll come into your organization and they will still get promoted and they will grow. And it takes several years to start seeing that payoff. We're starting to see that payoff now in my organization. I think operations is one of the hardest places to hire a gender equal workforce, because people look at that and either one, they, you know, it's been attractive to, I think, not women for a very long time. We don't do a great job of making it look sexy. And then the hours, if you're, you know, a mom and you're like, I can't afford to get up at 2 a.m. I've got kids. I've got to get kids off to school. And so being able to balance that, say not every job needs somebody to be on call at 2 in the morning. Not every job requires like deep depth and understanding like the Linux kernel. But there are plenty of roles out there. Like analytical minds work great in this role. Being able to question stuff. I found that the best skill set are people that ask questions and then are willing to put a plan together once you have the answer to those questions. Those two things are, I think those are my strongest skills, and anybody could bring those in the table. It doesn't take a depth of technology knowledge to bring those. You just have to be able to ask the right questions and be willing to keep digging until you get, I think, to a final answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. I know that you guys, and I think you spoke at this, I know that you've hosted many of these, but you did like NXT Next at 4240, which is a location here in St. Louis, celebrating women in tech and business. You spoke about the future of payments and e-commerce. I mean, what were some of the things that came out? You guys are awesome at this, you know, sponsoring things. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when it comes to innovation, because for as long as I can remember, Kim, you guys have done hackathons.
Right.
I participated in a few of those, you know, as a judge. But, you know, what were some of the things that came out of that? Do you remember? Do you recall?
I don't know that I recall specifically, but I do think the innovation piece is super interesting because I think we don't always think that we're innovative individually. I think we're thinking like, I don't have the next big idea. I don't know what the next, tokenization, I'm not going to be the guy that comes up with that. And most innovation is more about starting small and taking something and improving it, not coming up with, you know, the next
something brand new
thing. We do this thing in junior achievement where we tell the kids there's a difference between being, you know, the entrepreneur that comes up with the new thing and innovation, which is, you know, there was water and there were plastic bottles, but somebody had to put those two things together. And now people have portable water. That was an innovation. They didn't invent water and they didn't invent plastic bottles. Right. Exactly. That's innovation. And we don't think about that. We celebrate, you know, the big things like the flying cars. So thinking about that with my own team, we have every year we run a patent contest at MasterCard. And so we ask every division to think about ideas. They don't necessarily all get patented, but it starts the engine moving. And so you file what would be considered an invention idea. And so the first year we did this with my team, I think we filed, I want to say like 7 ideas across a couple thousand people. That was really sad. I think even the janitors at MasterCard filed more patents than my team. And so I said, well, next year we're going to try hard. Maybe I just didn't push this hard enough. So next year I think we filed 30. And so that was not slightly better, but still not really a lot for as many people as we had. So I was sitting at a happy hour with one of a bunch of what I would call the millennials at the time. And they were, which was back, so this was several years ago, when that was the most junior part of our workforce. And one of the gals said, we should make a contest out of it. And I said, that'd be great. You want to lead that? She's like, yes, we'd love to lead that. And so we did a contest that very first year. And I said, first of all, let's just tell people how you file one. Maybe people don't even know how to file a patentable idea. And let's just talk about what is innovation? What does that look like? And We went from 30 to 300 ideas. The next year, 350. The next year, 400. And doing the same thing. So doing a focus, doing a explaining to people what innovation means and how they contribute to that. And they don't have to come up with the next, you know, Tesla idea. It could be, you know, the water bottle. And so we lead the company, in fact, in the most ideas coming out of my team at this point. But it's because there's a focus on it and people see how they can contribute to the larger ecosystem.
I love that. I mean, and it was just that idea of gamifying it.
Yes, 100%.
You know? So good. Well, gosh, I've got pages and pages and pages left of things I want to talk to you about, Kim, but we do need to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Kim Martin on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
So welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend Kim Martin. So Kim, in 2016, you were recognized as a St. Louis Most Influential Businesswoman. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What an honor. You know, but I have to ask you, I was thinking about that, and I remember, and I told you in a sidebar conversation, I remember talking to a female leader at Bayer, and she said when she became a leader, she asked someone, now, okay, how do I have influence? You know, can you teach me how to have influence? So she'd ask a mentor of hers that question. But how do you define influence, and how do you foster influence as a woman, you know, and helping other women have influence? How do you define it?
Well, I think everybody has influence. They probably don't recognize it as such. Like if you're the person that gets your friends together and says, I think we should go out Friday night and this is where we should go. That's a leader. That's influencing people. You influence people by tapping into some common value, some common need that they have that they agree on. That's influence. I think there's a difference between influence and bulldozing. Like, you don't want to be a bulldozer because you might not have the right idea. And so you can get everybody to do what you asked them to do. It was completely the wrong thing and you all did it. I think when you have like the privilege of power, that actually is worse because you were accountable. You spent the company's money in the wrong way. You led people in the wrong direction. So influence is also making sure that you understand like what the direction should be, and you're getting feedback signals from lots of other people. Influence is also being able to tap into, like for me, influence in the roles that I have, I'm not necessarily the person that knows the right answer. I'm not always, in fact, I'm usually not the smartest person in the room, but deferring to who is and understanding if I think that what they have to say is the right thing to do, then getting everybody else on board, that's the role I can play. I can help facilitate by bringing together the data and the facts and helping people understand like this is the right thing to do. And we've got to make a risk decision here, folks. So this is what I want everybody to walk out of here aligned. That's influence. It's less about this is my way or the highway. I mean, that is like, I think, 1970s influence. This is today. It's collaborative influence.
Yes, it is. It is. And it's, I know that you're a very collaborative leader. You know, you were also a CIO Orby finalist this year. So congratulations to that. I mean, clearly, Kim, you are doing something correct. You're doing something right. You know, and it may be that collaboration, that influence to help collaborate. But, you know, what would you say are some of your qualities that really have helped you the most in being successful? Most influential businesswoman, CIO, Orby finalist. I mean, what would you say some of those qualities are?
I think we talked about it in the first half of this. It's like curiosity and then action driven. The curiosity part is like just as important as the action. Like the action is bad. If you're going in the wrong direction, driving faster in the wrong direction doesn't help.
It's not.
The curiosity part, we do something like, because we are in operations and IT stuff breaks, we call it the five whys. You know, I think Amazon does the same thing, probably Google. But the five whys are really meant about, like, I need to keep digging until I get to the root of the answer. Like, I don't take the surface answer. We do that too often. We observe, or we call it at MasterCard, admiring the problem. Oh, yeah. You know, like my car ran out of gas. Why did your car run out of gas? Well, I forgot to fill it up. Why did you forget to fill it up? Well, I was busy yesterday. Well, why were you busy yesterday? Well, I was doing other things and I didn't prioritize it. Okay, that I kind of got to the root cause. None of that will make me not mm-hmm. run out of gas next week if I don't do right. something different. So then the actionable part is, what am I going to do different? I'm going to put a reminder on my phone on Mondays to get gas on my car. Something like that. There has to be both the get to the true curiosity. So, and sometimes there's not just one, there's like 10 root causes to why something happened, and then putting the action in place to make sure, and maybe there's 10 actions that make sure this doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. I had never heard that before. The five whys. I'm going to use that now. It's just continue to dig, dig, dig.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the theory is keep asking until you've got to about five is about the right number, you know, mm-hmm. and then sometimes you start a chain, a different chain of five whys.
Yeah, that's good. I really, really like that. Well, I want to talk to you about this because, again, I mean, not to tickle your ears, but MasterCard, you guys just do so much good stuff for the community, Kim. And I know that you guys hosted or sponsored a neurodiverse workforce summit. You were the executive sponsor for that within MasterCard. You know, first of all, tell our listeners, what do you mean by neurodiverse?
So we have, well, first of all, we have a business resource group called ADAPT, and it is really for bringing together people with non-typical skills. And so neurodiversity is one of those. So the neurodiverse in our community, sometimes we don't always recognize the amazing things that they bring to the workforce. So this was focused on getting community hiring companies to think about, like, give neurotypical people an opportunity in your workforce. We did a program at least a year or so ago, where we started bringing in like an internship program of just neurodiverse candidates. Neurodiverse candidates, there's a range of them. There's not a typical neurotypical person, in fact. So bringing in a range of folks and understanding like the very special skills that they bring to the table. For example, really good at data analysis and digging into those, asking those questions that I just talked about. So, you know, you want a team of diversity anyway. So somebody that complements your entire team is, you know, this would be a great way to bring that kind of different thinking to your table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. So you guys, I mean, obviously you spearheaded this, but, you know, I mean, and you've just told me that. So you kind of started with interns, right?
Right.
I said, what have you guys done to embrace that? You know, you guys are not the only company embracing it. I think SAP,
yeah.
You know, has the Autism at Work program, which is wonderful. IBM has a neurodiversity program. So does KPMG. Looking at the ability, not the disability. And of course, you know, for me, Kim, I say every person is uniquely gifted.
Absolutely.
With something extra. You know, you just got to figure out what that is. And all those something extras are important, you
right.
know, and can really contribute. What suggestions do you have, though, for companies who possibly, you know, would love to be able to include a neurodiverse demographic in their workforce strategy? I mean, do you have a couple of, you know, accommodations? You may have to make some special accommodations.
Yeah, but they're not expensive. Like maybe you need noise canceling headphones for your neurodiverse. You know, maybe it's too noisy or mm-hmm. an environment. But these are not big things. And don't you want your workforce to be productive anyway? Probably what your neurodiverse candidates want, the rest of your neurotypical candidates want too.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. That's really good. Well, I have to ask you this because you guys are figuring it out. I mean, you guys are already doing it, but I talked to a lot of CIOs and a lot of tech execs, Kim. There's not one that is not thinking about AI and a generative AI strategy. And I think you guys have, is it called the AI Garage?
But that's one thing that we have, yes.
That's one thing? I mean, you guys have, you know, already kind of figured this out a little bit. You know, you launched an AI model just this year to allow banks to better assess suspicious transactions. I mean, tell me a little bit about what you guys, how are you using AI? How are you thinking about it?
Well, I think we talked about a little earlier too, like back in 93, we built our very first neural network. I mean, we modeled. So we've been refining the practice since 1993. We have one of our largest award-winning decision management platform, which runs hundreds of models on every transaction that flies across our network. So hundreds of millions of transactions a day hit this neural network model. And there are many models that apply depending on, these are all fraud models, by the way, scoring for fraud likelihood to help banks assess the likelihood that you are who you say you are. And so that's just one aspect of it, looking at other ways that we can use generative AI. I had a call the other day with a company, a big medical data company, and how they're using Gen AI. Like, are they using it for productivity for programming? They found that oddly, it's not great for programming productivity, but it is great for testing productivity or for studying like legacy code that you don't necessarily understand. You don't want developers spending time trying to figure it out. It can give you a summary of what the application is doing. So there's a lot of different ways I think that we will see AI pop up in the workforce beyond just commercial ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. So TechLX, I mean, we technology partners, we've been very blessed to be a partner for MasterCard. Goodness, we have been in business for 30 years in May, and I think you guys have been a client. We've been a partner for maybe 28 of those years or something, Kim. So we've been incredibly blessed. But in 2019, we launched the TechLX program, the Technology Leadership Experience here in St. Louis. And you guys were one of the first to put your hat in the ring, and you've put people through that. You have been a mentor. In fact, I'll just embarrass you a little bit more, but Kim won the Mentoring Excellence Award last year. And, you know, so growing people is really important to MasterCard. I know that's not the only thing you do. You do other things as well. But
I love the TechLX program, though, because it lets our people meet other leaders across other companies. Too often we're only talking to ourselves, and you need those signals. And some of the greatest mentoring that they are able to get some great leadership skills and tips from people across companies across the St. Louis area. It's a phenomenal opportunity. I would encourage anybody, if your company can join it, that's an amazing program. And you put together a phenomenal group of organizations that contribute to it. It's also fun to be a mentor in it too. So if you're always looking for mentors, I think this is a great opportunity. I met some astounding talent in the St. Louis area. So it was always fun.
Yes. Oh, well, we just appreciate you guys being a part of it. We just launched cohort 13.
Yeah.
We've had over 300 people go through the program. We just talked yesterday. We're looking at launching another all-female TechLX this summer. So, but if you're at all interested in learning more about that, please reach out and we can get you connected. So I have a little lightning round here that I want to do with you, Kim, before we talk about something extra. But what would you say is the best piece of advice that you've ever received? I know that's really hard because you probably received some good ones.
I think question everything. That was what my dad used to say. My dad was a Baptist minister, and he's like, yeah, you have permission to question everything. You should question everything so you know why you believe what you believe.
I love that. I love that. Do you have a morning routine?
I do.
Besides getting up at 3 a.m.?
I do. I put together a bunch of my dad's writings during COVID. So I put together in a daily devotional form. Now I read them. So I read a devotional a day. And it's like a connection back to my dad because he passed away in 2009. But it's a great way to start the day.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you start with the daily devotional. Are you reading anything right now? And if you are, what are you reading?
It's not a new book. It's written by Aaron Meyer. It's called The Culture Map. But I was really intrigued by it because again, global teams. And she's like, as an American, we come at it with a point of view. And she gave an example how she started working with a firm in Paris. And she completely boggled the whole relationship because she thought everybody would think like us. Like what would be a value to us would be a value in every workforce around the world. And that's so not true. And you have to temper and modify the way you engage. And I'm like, this is so interesting. And my observations do.
Right. Yeah. And it certainly helps you because you've got teams all over the globe, right, Kim? So that's good. Obviously, that's one way you grow, right? Are there other ways that you grow as an individual? I think you guys are really, aren't you guys very involved in Grace Hopper?
We have been. We continue to invest in, I think my favorite program is like working though, and more in the St. Louis area. We've done some partnerships with a couple organizations, bringing in like Launch Code, bringing in people mm-hmm. maybe from a different career family. And then we're doing a program now on bringing in high school, high potential high school students that are from areas where they might not be able to go to college. So we're giving them their first job. And it's been so interesting because you learn a lot. Like you take for granted all the things you know, like how does one go buy a car? Like these are things, these kids, they're getting a salary that's enough for them to be able to now start making different life decisions. And they have no idea, how do I invest my money? These are fun things mm-hmm. to work with them on.
Yeah. And to your point, you learn as much, you know, sometimes from them as you're teaching them. You know, let me ask you this. How do you stay up to date with the latest tech trends? And we already talked about this before we even started. You said you're a big Gartner person.
Absolutely.
You know, but you've got
read a
to
ton. I don't think anybody can get by without having a lot of different signals, and they're not opinions diverse. So you want to get a steady diet of lots of different ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's good. I'll ask you this. So I've got two more questions for you. Now I'm going to talk about something extra. Do you have a particular app or tool or gadget, Kim, that you could not live without?
I think it's Microsoft Excel. It is because, you know, data geek. Yeah. Love Excel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's powerful, isn't it? So, you know, you've got a husband, Robert, you've got two sons, Matthew and Andrew. You got a big, big job at MasterCard. How do you balance it? I mean, how do you, and I don't really believe in true balance, but how do you manage it all and keep your sanity and keep from burning out, Kim? I guess is the big question.
Yeah, I think balance is, you know, always been an overused word, work-life balance. I think it's just work-life correctness for you, for whatever it is in that time. When my boys were babies, obviously I spent more time in the mama role than in the MasterCard role. And as they grew up, and depending on what was going on in our life, sometimes MasterCard needed more attention. Sometimes it was like that cranky baby waking up at 3 a.m. and it needed the attention. And so it's always it's daily reprioritization. I mean, isn't that what we do as project managers, as people managers? It's always constant prioritization. It's the same thing when you're dealing with a team. It's like not everybody in your team needs your attention every minute of every day, but maybe one person needs it more today than everybody else. That you're going to pivot. That's the attention I'm going to give today. And so every day is a pivot, and you hope that you're putting your priorities in the right place. Again, going back to your value statement, are my priorities matching? Am I living the way I've prioritized and said my values live?
Yeah, love that. Well, this is called Something Extra. Kim, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
I would say it's curiosity. And I, you know, I read some articles because I wanted to look really smart here today, and I didn't see anybody that said curiosity. So that may not be a good thing, but I really believe if you don't have the curiosity, then it all spawns from there.
Yeah. No, you're not the first.
Oh, good.
I will tell you my very first episode, and now we're close to 300 episodes. My very first episode was with Maxine Clark, who is the founder of Build-A-Bear.
Yeah.
And that is her something extra, is staying curious, because you're curious as a child.
Yeah.
And she said, sometimes along the way, we lose that. And she's like, maintain that curiosity, because
Amen.
That's where new ideas are going to come out and improvements. So, yeah. So that's, you're right in there with Maxine.
Oh, good.
So, Kim, this has been so much fun.
Absolutely.
I so appreciate you making the time to be on the show, and I cannot wait for our listeners to learn from you. It's a rich conversation, and I know that they're going to learn a lot from you.
So honored, Lisa. Always such a pleasure to spend any time with you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.